Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. I decided not to put up an episode on Friday because Sam's episode was so long that I didn't want to overburden the listeners. I went to Sam's show that night, and I was joking with her that perhaps maybe I should have broken it up into two episodes. I think it was, we clocked out at, 135 minutes or something like that. 2 hours and 15 minutes. Even Sam told me that she got about halfway through it and then had to go to bed. So I just decided, you know, take the weekend off and just recharge the batteries. Also, I realize it's 11:30 on Tuesday, and as I'm recording this, I'm a bad host, but my baseball fandom is getting in the way of everything, specifically my Blue Jays fandom. There was doubleheader today between the Jays and Royals, so I've spent the last 6-plus hours, I guess, watching baseball and not podcasting, not writing, not doing any of my other obligations. So, I guess that's why I'm late. Anyway. Sent out my first sponsorship email today, not for the podcast, but for my theater show. The theater show is called Amsterdam. So, naturally, the first sponsorship request I sent went out to Amsterdam Brewery, which I think was kind of a given. So, we'll see how that goes. But, enough about me. Let's talk about the show. It's a really good show today. We have a couple of great indie actors. One's up and coming. One's been around for a while and comes from a show biz family. So there's a show on TV that you may have heard of, and it's said that it's maybe resurrected network television a little bit in the last year. I'm speaking, of course, of This Is Us, which won all sorts of Emmys after its first season, most notably Sterling K. Brown, and the second season premiered back in September. For a few episodes at the end of the second season, we see that the character teenage Randall is dating this redheaded girl who we first meet the night of Jack's death. And then we don't see her again for a while, and then she pops up again towards the end of the season. The actress that plays that role goes by the name of Isabel Oliver Marcus. And I got to speak with her a couple of weeks ago about her role in season 2. She appears in 5 episodes in total, originally introduced as the redheaded teen girl. We later learned that her name is Allison. And before she landed This Is Us, she was working as a babysitter, as many young people do. And she'd only ever appeared in one film before This Is Us. It was a bit part in a film called The Remake, as well as she appeared in a short called Troubled Waters. So, This Is Us is by far her biggest and her most notable role on screen. We talked about what it was like for her joining a show already in progress and a show that had been so wildly successful and such a ratings behemoth. And of course, you know, working with people like Milo and Mandy and Sterling and Chrissy. So this is my conversation with actress Elizabeth Oliver Marcus. And I apologize. There are a couple of points where it goes in and out. She was not in the best place reception-wise, but we get through it. So here is me, I should say, with Isabel Oliver Marcus. Isabel Marcus, hello. Welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, This Is Us. You are featured in season two. What was it like for you not only joining a show in after their first season is always an interesting experience, but you joined what was probably the biggest show on network television. Do you remember what you felt when you got the call saying you had the part of Allison?
I do. I remember it went something like, my manager called me and he was like, hey, how are you? And I was like, I'm fine. And of course, the build up up until this point had been an audition and a chemistry read and me flying out to Los Angeles by myself and all kinds of like very anxiety driven things. But I was like trying to stay calm and he was like, hey, how's it going? And I was like, I'm good. And so he was building the tension. And then he was like, so I just wanted to let you know that you, like, got it. And then I said, I got it. And then he was like, you got it. And then I said, I got it. And that went on for a while. And it was basically a mixture of, like, stunned excitement and anticipation and crazy nerves and sort of all of the things that happen when big things occur in your life, when, you know, I knew that it was a moment for me, and it was a big deal, so.
And I understand that you almost didn't get to audition because you were in Texas at the time, and they wanted people who could be in the room in Los Angeles. How were you and your agent able to convince the guys to for you to submit a video audition?
Yeah, so that's right. I was visiting family in Texas, and I got the call for the audition, and I was like, I can't make it. And it was supposed to be really secretive, but you know, four of the five younger versions on the show, or younger kids on the show, that is Kate and Kevin, and young Sophie. Are all with my agent over at Abrams Artists, Domina Holbeck. So, so it really was just, I think they've got a relationship and she's a fantastic agent. It's a fantastic agency. All of my agents over there at Abrams are really, really solid. And I think it just comes from the history of the agency and the relationship between the agency and the casting directors.
So tell me, you before this, I know you were working in babysitting. This has to be that profession, doesn't it?
Well, babysitting isn't exactly right. It was my baby brother. He was about 4 months old at the time. And I have babysat before. But mostly I had worked in, I'd done student films and short films and music videos. And so there was a buildup toward this step in my profession. I would not call babysitting my job at the time, although I do enjoy hanging out with my baby brother. But also for the last 12 years, my profession has been school. So at the time it was like summer break and kind of hard to wrap my head around, like, oh, I'm doing my job in the middle of summer. That's crazy. But it was very exciting and really good, and I'm glad to be able to do what I love all year long.
Not only do you join one of the biggest shows on television, but we probably first see you in one of the most emotional scenes, at least in the first episode, if not in the entire season. What was that like for you, walking into such an emotional moment?
You know, unfortunately, I hadn't gotten to see the whole of the first season when I actually stepped foot on set, because I didn't get to see the show. I had seen previews for it, and I was like, dude, that looks really, really interesting. And I think I knew, watching the previews, that it was going to be something big, but I didn't know exactly what it was, and I didn't have context for it. And then when I got the audition, you know, I rushed over to my aunt's house and watched the first episode because she had access to it. It was the first and last episodes of the season. But I didn't know exactly the scope of it, and I didn't know how invested people really, really were. And I was only just a little bit familiar with the death of Jack and with all of the circumstances surrounding that, but I could feel being on set. I felt how important it was to these magnificent actors I'm working with, Niles Fitch and Hannah Zeal and John Huertas. I mean, they were so absolutely committed to the story because they've been part of it from the beginning, and they understood, and then and it was a great sad but great environment to be working in with these characters, these actors who are so connected to their characters and so invested in the story. And everyone on set is invested in the story in the same way. And then I went home and I watched the whole of the first season before they called me back to shoot again. And then I got it. I was like, oh, yes, of course. It's so poignant. It's so emotional, and it's so poignant and so important as a story, a plot point, and also as character development for these folks. And then I was really glad to get to be part of the rest of the story arc too, you know, in the episode about, in the Super Bowl episode about Jack's death, and then in the subsequent episode at the funeral, and also in the episodes building up to it. You know, Allison got to be sort of a marker to alert the audience that it was getting close. She was sort of like a, just so you know, it's happening, a road marker. And so I felt very fortunate, and my character felt very fortunate to be part of this magnificent storytelling.
When it came time for Jack's death, which we all knew was coming, and the lead up to that, how much did you and the other actors know in advance? How much script did you get, and or when exactly did they tell you that this is how Jack dies?
So I did not know on the first day of shooting, for the first episode, or the first day of my shooting, for the first episode, they told everyone else in my scene but me. They did not tell me, and they did not tell me any of it, basically at all. I learned all of the details along with the audience, which was actually a really great experience, because for the three leading up episodes, I had read the script before, and so I knew everything that was going to happen. And because it's so wonderfully written, both on paper and on screen, like I could visualize everything that was happening. And so the episodes, while wonderful, weren't new. And oh, look at the donkey! Sorry. So I got to experience the whole of the heartbreak with the audience, but I did get the opportunity. The script for the Super Bowl episode came on red paper, and normally it couldn't be photocopied. And normally they email me the script a couple of days before, and they did not email me the script. I worked the day before we were supposed to shoot the Super Bowl episode, and then gave me the script there at the end of my day. And it was only 3 or 4 pages, only relevant to me. They had crossed out all of the rest of the information. Whatever was said. And then I with Randall. I got the full extent of it there, and I was crying. Honestly, I was like off camera because once I had exited the scene, and I was crying. I thought I had to leave the room so that they couldn't hear my sobs because it was so emotional, and it was such beautiful work done by all three of them. And they're just such talented folks. So I got to learn all of the details right then and there, and then the rest of the circumstances later in the actual episode. But as far as I'm aware, everyone else got full script. Or that is Mandy. Justin and Niles, the three kids, they all got full copies of the script on red paper for themselves.
I heard you say in an interview that some of the episodes really stretched your sort of emotional acting abilities. Do you remember what was the most difficult scene for you to shoot?
And I just want to mention really quick, I accidentally said Justin, and I meant Logan. Logan is the younger version of Kevin. Sorry about that. The most emotional, I think, for me, was the shooting of the Super Bowl episode. It was hard to know for me. I have to remember Allison's involvement in the family. She's not been around for very long. She's been very long, but she has been there for a few times. And so I had to sort of recall that for myself and allow that to inform how I felt, and also to allow myself fully to connect with Randall, with young Randall, because, you know, Allison, they like each other. They like each other. They may even love each other. Allison has to be willing to give herself over entirely, taking care of him, and he in some ways fills that role when Rebecca has to be taking care of herself. So Kevin has Sophie and Allison has, I mean, Randall has Allison, and unfortunately Kate resorts to other measures to sort of care for herself. And then we get to see in the funeral episode Rebecca take charge and be there for her family, and that was a really important time. But anyway, that those scenes in episode 14 were I think the most difficult and the most important for me. But I also, on a technical level, episode 12, where we actually get to meet Allison rather than just see her sitting on a couch, we see her in the mall, and that was a technically challenging scene to shoot because they changed every single one of my lines, and it's in a mall, and so it's easy to get distracted, and it's not a closed set, and so there's different sounds, and it's an unfamiliar location. So just in general, that was a technically more difficult scene to shoot. But all around, episode 14 was emotionally more drastic.
Do you remember what it was like your very first day on set? And were you excited to meet Mandy and Milo?
It was incredible. And I was very excited. I did not get to meet Milo first day because I didn't have to shoot with him. I got to shoot with John and Hannah and Niles, who are just incredible people and incredible actors. It felt so good to be working with such professionals. They're so professional and so on top of it. Whatever that means, TV set, certainly for a big station. So it was just huge. It was momentous. It was a really, really big deal for me. But I got through it, and I'll never forget it.
What I find really interesting about the show is we talk so much about streaming and web series, you know, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, and it seems like this show has revitalized network television a little bit. What do you make of that?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, it is on Hulu, so anyone looking to catch up, go over there. I think that this is a really important time in the history of the world and in the history of the United States. We're going through technological changes, political changes, social changes, and wherever you fall on the spectrum of those events, it's a really interesting time for art to be going through, because art both reflects and affects the social and political and landscape. So I think it, in many ways, it connects with so many people, and it tells such diverse and interesting stories. And they sort of go hand in hand in that the technology of television has allowed us to see more television, and the technology of streaming and Netflix has allowed us to reflect our society more quickly and more determinedly. And so I think they're going hand in hand, and they're working together just the same way that This Is Us is on Hulu. Hopefully network television will continue to be able to be seen on the network and also on streaming platforms so that the stories reach wider.
You were in 5 episodes of season 2. Do you know if you'll be in season 3 yet?
I have no idea, but I very, very, very much hope so. Again, they don't really tell me anything, but I'm going to just pretend that I am and say I look forward very much to coming back and seeing where Allison is taken.
Well, the show is This Is Us, and you can, I think, season 2... At least season 1 is on Netflix now, and I think you can catch season 2 on Hulu as well. And we look forward to seeing if This Is Us does well at the Emmys again this year. Isabel Marcus, thanks so much for your thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was really good to talk to you.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too. Bye.
That was my conversation with the actress Isabel Oliver Marcus, who plays the role of Allison, the redheaded girl, on the hit series This Is Us. Season 2 finale was last month, but season 1 can currently be found on Netflix. Well, there are many acting families that are multi-generational that are considered Hollywood royalty or dynasties. Got the Barrymores, Coppolas, Redgraves. You had Carrie Fisher, Billy Lord, Debbie Reynolds, Edie Fisher. You have Bruce Paltrow, Gwyneth Paltrow, Jake Paltrow, Blythe Danner, Bruce Dern, Laura Dern, Diane Ladd. You get the idea. But what about the Sorvino family? You may have heard of them. Mira Sorvino, of course, won a Best Supporting Actress Oscar for Mighty Aphrodite, and her father, Paul, is also a long-time renowned character actor. But there are other members of this great family, and one of them is Mira's cousin and Paul's nephew, Bill Sorvino. Sure, Bill will tell you that he doesn't have that big film to his name that Paul or Mira do, but as he stated in the interview, when somebody asks me, oh, what's he been in? He's like, oh, 20 different things that are floating out in cyberspace. So he's worked a lot in indie film, and he's also directed a short film and an episode of television, as well as co-written two short films. Some of his films, you know, there's A Place for Heroes, Mommy Box, Confidence Gain. He just finished a film where he plays Benito Mussolini in a film titled Yellow Scared, which, by the looks of it, lampoons and parodies World War II. He just completed a film with a great title called The Tomato Limbo, which I love, and another great thriller called Iron Terry Malone, which co-stars Holt McCallany, who you may remember from Men of Honor, as well as Maureen Van Zant and Vincent Pastore from The Sopranos. Speaking of Vincent Pastore, he has a bit part in the new comedy film Who's Jenna, in which Bill Sorvino plays the lead role of Jonathan Burke. The film follows Jonathan, a financial advisor, who starts dating Jenna Casey, a lawyer. Now, Jonathan's best friend Andy is convinced that she looks exactly like a famous adult film star. And it's sort of an interesting take on the romantic comedy, you know, because it's almost an anti romantic comedy in a way, and it touches a lot on wealth inequality, affirmative action, and capitalism as well. And what's really interesting is that the porn star that Jenna, the character in the movie, gets mistaken for, is named Amber Lynn. And Amber Lynn herself, that's Amber Lynn. And Amber Lynn herself makes a cameo right at the end of the movie. So that's just an interesting little thing that they got going on there. So I got to speak with Bill Sorvino last week about his role in the film and what it means to him to be so present in the indie film world, and also a lot of the social commentary that takes place within this film. The film is Who's Jenna? And this is my conversation with lead actor Bill Sorvino. Bill Sorvino, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks for having me on.
So, your new film is Who's Jenna? I just had a chance to watch it, and there's a lot going on, but what first attracted you to the role of Jonathan Burke?
Well, you know, Tom Baldinger, the director, he had approached me about the film after he saw me in a couple of things, some film festivals and stuff like that. We had a chance to talk, and then he was like, oh, I have this film that I want you to, he actually had two, but this was the one he was shooting next. And, you know, I have a few roles in mind for you, that I think you'd be great for. So I said, yeah, sure, let me read it. And I thought it was really just a really funny movie with a great concept. It's a little different, romantic comedy, but definitely lots of plot twists and stuff like that that made it much more interesting than your standard rom-com. And the main character, you know, Jonathan, who I played, was, you know, juggling a whole whirlwind of craziness, which I felt was just really, it would have been a lot of fun to play. So, you know, I feel like I do that in my personal life anyway, so I felt it wasn't much of a stretch. So basically, you know, and he had me in mind for that or the best friend role. And I just gravitated towards this. And I said, hey, I'd much rather play the main character guy because I just completely related to it. And of course, the script is great and funny. And that was really it, you know, that pretty much how it typically goes in a great movie.
I think, you know, in the last sort of 5 years, decade or so, we've been seeing a reinvention of the rom-com. You know, it's not just man, you know, boy meets girl. There's a lot more, I think, character development involved. What do you like specifically about the story and the genre of a romantic comedy?
Well, you know, I'm not typically much of a fan of rom-coms unless they're wrapped around, you know, or unless wrapped around it. The love story would be, you know, something wild going on, which that's what this is. And so the few rom-coms that I actually have watched are because of that, because they have, you know, kind of, you know, it's not really a rom-com per se. There's a romance going on, but there's a story outside of that that's much maybe more relevant to the story than the actual romance. So, yeah, and I think people, yeah, we're in a fast-paced society now, and people are, you need, you know, give me the goods, you know, and you need a movie that gives more than just your typical love story, boy meets girl, and they fall in love, and, you know, sail off into the sunset. You know, it's got to be really interesting these days, and, you know, people are much more sophisticated than they used to be. So, you know, and this has that, and I think that's why you're seeing that.
It strikes me that this film satirizes a lot of things, not least of all Italian Americans and sort of that mob mentality that comes with living in New York City. What kind of conversations did you have with Tom, the director, about that attitude and sort of how to portray that at all?
So, I mean, I didn't portray that personally. Like, I you know, my portrayal was a guy, like more of a straight-laced guy who is caught up in some of that world because of my boss, who's kind of, you know, has one foot in that world and one foot in the regular world. So for me, it was, it was more about like, how do I deal with these characters that are like that? You know, and as related to my character, who is a straight-laced guy who is, you know, who sees the right in things and wants to write, make things right with the world, so to speak. So, yeah, it was interesting dealing with that kind of stuff. I've done that in some other films, you know, a little bit. So, you know, it wasn't such new territory for me, but it was definitely fun territory to play. But, yeah, it's got that element too, yeah.
And I think another aspect of satire that I think is really relevant in the cultural moment that we're in is the idea of masculinity and sort of toxic hyper-masculinity. Was that a conversation that came in that you had at all, either in regards to the film as a whole or specific characters within the film?
Well, I think what we were dealing with was, I don't know about if I would definitely label it as toxic masculinity, although that was in there as an element with those mob guys, as well as my boss Joe Barsha, who's played brilliantly by Gary Pastore. You know, that I think it was bigotry, which is more the focus of what that all is about, and looking at bigotry and, you know, using the film as a sort of a platform to show how insane and that kind of thinking really is. And it comes, it's being said, these things are being said within the film, but it's not about, it's not senseless. It's not like humor. It's not like Howard Stern senseless humor, if you want to call it that. It's funny, but then there's the human element of, hey, this is not cool, you know? And that's what my character was doing, was like, this is bullshit. I don't know if I can curse, but this is baloney. I don't accept this type of bigotry and the way my boss is treating different people around me. And then there's plot twists within that we see come, you know, bring it all together, which I don't want to give away, but it's pretty cool how Tom came up with that, actually.
So your character works in wealth management, which to a lot of people might seem dull and unfamiliar. But for you playing that character, what kind of research did you have to do into that world?
You know, I honestly, I didn't do a whole heck of a... So Tom works in wealth management, so I was able to discuss a lot of that with him. And I don't have any relation to that world whatsoever. But what my preparation for the role on that was more on the end of not the job of wealth management, the job of managing people's expectations within your within what you're doing for them, what the service you're providing for them, and how I would want to treat my clients the way I would want to be treated. So that was more the gist of how I went about my character, was to portray someone who's feeling like he's being told to treat his clients, I don't know if I would say inappropriately, but like definitely not correctly, not nicely, and how I'm trying to juggle and manage that situation, because it goes against my grain as a person in the film, you know. So wealth management, you know, I played some of that, you know, from just, you know, just acting. But it was really the personal aspect of it that I played more so with my preparation.
You mentioned earlier, you know, this idea of fighting bigotry. And one of the interesting aspects in the film is the conversations that not only Jonathan has with Andy, but the boss as well, surrounding pornography. Do you think society has a wrong or negative idea of that industry and what it does?
I think to some degree, you know, I wouldn't necessarily say I'm like all about promoting porn, but I wouldn't also say these people are human beings that are doing a legal job, you know? So, and in the film there, that is being used as a leverage point by my boss for not reasons that he's making it out to be. So it's all about using a, you know, in the film, it's all about using that as just as a point of like I said, leverage, but inappropriately being used. So it's not really, he's not against it, you know what I mean? So yeah. As far as porn goes, you know, hey, look, to each his own. If it's legal, it's legal. You know, I personally wouldn't do it, you know, but, I have nothing against people who do porn as a career, as a job, whatever. And I think that they're human beings. A lot of them are. Amber Lynn is such a sweetheart. You know, we had her, you know, at some of the screenings and stuff, and she's a wonderful woman. I mean, she's a person just like you and me.
Speaking of Amber Lynn, the character of Jenna is often or has said that she looks like Amber Lynn. And in this day and age of celebrity, I'm curious, is if you have been mistaken for another famous person?
I have, oddly enough. I've been mistaken for various celebrities over the years, strangely. I one time, John Stamos, very oddly. One time, Mickey Rourke. Like three or four different times in my life, I'm like, what? That came out of completely left field, you know, oddly.
What do you do in that situation?
I'm like, no, but thank you. I'm not him, but thank you. They're very handsome fellows that I would definitely like being, resembling.
But, you know, speaking of celebrity, how does it feel to be part of what is considered your family being acting royalty in a way?
Oh, it's really great. It's cool, obviously. My uncle is, to me, one of the greatest actors ever. He's up there with the greats. And just to see him work, I've worked with him, and he's mentored me to some degree as well. And Mira, of course. You know, it's a wonderful thing. You know, it's a double-edged sword because I wanted to stake my own piece or place in the acting world and not have people compare me to them or have expectations based upon what my last name is or even give me an open door because of my last name. I really just want to accomplish these things on my own merit and my own training and background and talent and what I bring to a project or to the table. So, yeah, it's great. And at the same time, I don't want it to be a crutch or any kind of misinterpretation of who I represent or how I represent myself.
Is there, speaking of expectations, is there, when you tell people you're an actor, do people have certain ideas or expectations of what that is? And also, being an Italian-American actor, are there certain expectations that come with having that identity?
Yeah. That's a great question. So, as far as being an actor and someone saying, and you tell someone you're an actor, oh, then what have you been in? And I can tell them I've been in 20 movies, but like, where can I see them? I'm like, well, you know, they're kind of scattered around the internet, basically, you know? So that's a tough thing, you know? Until I'm on like a TV series as a star, it's hard to tell people you're an actor because, you know, even though I'm constantly working, it's like stuff you kind of like have to find, you know? You know, or if I get into like a major feature film that's in all the theaters, you know, which is all action movie or whatever, you know, Marvel. But as far as being an Italian-American actor, I find it kind of disturbing that people pigeonhole you into that you are an Italian person that could play mob characters, cops, construction workers. And when people get to, when in fact I had an agent who, his assistant was trying to submit me for roles many years ago. And he goes, you know, let's get you in to have a meeting. And I went in there, and they're like, oh, gosh, I was submitting you all along because based on your name and your picture, I thought you were going to be a Goomba. I don't know what you want to call it. I'm allowed to say that I'm Italian. But, and like, you're just like a guy. I'm like, yeah, I'm like a person who's an actor, you know. I'm not an Italian actor. I'm a person who's an actor who happens to be of Italian heritage. And I pride myself on the amount of training that I've done as an actor, and not just, I just didn't go out there and start acting one day. I went to 3 years of school. I went to one of the best schools in the world, William Esper Studio, who, you know, did world renowned. So, I mean, and I spent a lot of time at my craft and doing films and working my way up the ladder. So yeah, that is a point of contention, as you can see, for me. It's a little annoying sometimes.
You know, it's funny, in the press release that I got for this, it says Sopranos favorites reunite. And in terms of portrayal of Italian-Americans, what do you make of a show like that?
You know, it's a fantastic show. It was extremely well executed. It was one of the groundbreaking, TV series, absolutely. I actually loved watching it, but it also felt like it was kind of, you know, sensationalizing this whole mob thing and kind of giving, maybe throwing a bad light on to Italian Americans as a whole. However, I'm all for great entertainment, so it didn't bother me that much as other people I know that are Italian Americans, they couldn't stand it, they hated it. Like, it slightly bothers me that it's maybe cast like not such a wonderful light on Italian Americans, but at the same time, it's amazing entertainment, which I was able to appreciate.
Sort of a minor plot point in the film surrounds the character of Scott and how your boss doesn't want to promote him. And I'm curious, why do you think we need that the character is black and gay? Why do you think we need affirmative action in a case like this, especially in the current world that we're living in?
Well, you need to compensate for the fact that there has been a stigma for how long, you know, slavery. Okay, we're going to go into the black section of things. Slavery ended only in the mid-1800s, and then segregation only ended in the 1960s. Okay, so we as a human race in America, we're effing up royally. And everyone who falls under those categories, anyone who's not in the standard, you know, I don't know, white conservative person in the middle there, has a harder time. You know, I've seen it firsthand as an Italian guy. You know, not just a straight up whatever. You know, that expected white conservative guy. We need to play catch up. We absolutely need to, as a society, we need to play catch up for those who were left behind for many, many, many years, including women, you know, including gay, including, you know, the blacks, anyone who is of a different than what was originally America. We had to play catch up with, because we were screwing them up royally.
Your character does travel to Toronto for a scene or two in the film. Thoughts on this city?
You know, I have never been in Toronto. We didn't shoot it there. Oh. I don't know. I wish that we had, and I'd love to get there.
Have you ever been able to shoot anywhere in Canada?
No, I've been to Canada. I've been to Quebec and that area, but I've never shot in Canada yet, no.
I think one interesting aspect of this film that we sort of touch on a little bit is the, you know, ethics when it comes into confrontation with capitalism. And capitalism will always be a part of our society, but what do you think needs to happen in terms of the system before we can see real change, whether it's to do with money, whether it's to do with power, whether it's to do with, you know, this whole Me Too culture movement that we're in? Do you think anything specific needs to happen in order for us to see real change?
Well, I'm a firm believer in capitalism. I'll say that right off the bat. But I am what you might call I'm extremely down the middle in terms of politics. I guess I would say socially I'm pretty liberal. In terms of on the other side, I'm kind of conservative. I believe in capitalism. However, I believe that there are parts of the laws and regulations that are in favor of bigger companies, so that even the small business owner doesn't, even though he's a capitalist and he's trying to make it happen, he doesn't have the same advantages as a gigantic company, which is completely upside down, which is completely wrong. Okay, so there are, yes, capitalism is great if it's a fair playing field, and it's not. That's the problem. It's not a fair playing field. So, you know, for instance, you can have your money offshore if you're a big company, a Starbucks or whoever, and a small company that does it, they come down on them because they're easy to hit up. The big company would be too hard to hit up, so they hit up the small guy. So, you know, the way laws are enforced, the way regulations are set up, the way the lobbyists are only in benefit of the big companies, because that's who's paying for the lobbyists, that's what's messed up with the system. Capitalism in itself is great when it's being affected and influenced by the wrong people and with the wrong thinking and politicians taking money. That's when it gets messed up. And it becomes a complete distortion of its original concept.
You mentioned that you sort of joked that your films are scattered amongst the internet. What do you like about in smaller independent films, and in particular, as opposed to some of these maybe, you know, huge $700 million budget films?
I really like the ability to be collaborative within the indie films. I like the I like that we're telling the human stories, really just the human narrative, not, you know, bing, bang, boom, you know, keep people interested because they get a look at their phone if it's not jump cuts every 2 seconds, you know, which is, I can't watch fight scenes, you know, they cut, and it's like the whole pattern that they do these days, because people do not pay attention anymore. You know, they have to look at their phone if it's beyond 3 seconds. So what we're doing is in the indie world is we're telling real stories, trying to be very entertaining and interesting. But yeah, you do have to sit down and watch it and engage with it. And if it's well made, you will find that it's almost like reading a book instead of instead of seeing like a big thriller movie, action movie or whatever, you know, you have to soak it in, you know, you have to sit down and take a moment and breathe and enjoy something and stop the world for a minute, the madness, you know? So that's what I like about the indie filmmaking.
Do you have a favorite scene that, or a favorite memory that you had from working on this set?
Oh, from Who's Janet? Oh gosh, there were a lot of good ones. We had a, Tracy and I had some really wonderful scenes together. Tracy's a wonderful actress, Tracy Birdsall, you know, she played Jenna. And she's a wonderful actress, wonderful, wonderful woman in person. And we had some terrific scenes together. For instance, when we kind of, I don't want to give things away, but like when we, there's a great, you know, happy scene between the two of us. There's, we have a fight scene, which really played off well. But then there was Joe DiNaprio. He's a great comedic actor. And we were, you know, we had a few, he was so improv, he did some improv work in one of the scenes in the house that we were cutting up. I mean, we were dying laughing. So I think a couple of scenes, one scene from him, a scene or two from her, like I really, really enjoyed doing.
And there is a scene in the beginning where you sing karaoke. I'm curious, do you have a go-to karaoke song?
The other, a few weeks ago, I was at a friend's birthday party and we sang My Way from Frank Sinatra. And that was a lot of fun. I like those Frank Sinatra, Summer Wind I've done. I think I'm like a Sinatra, I'm Italian, you know, what can I tell you? So I love the Sinatra stuff. So that would be probably it.
Well, the film is Who's Jenna, and it's out on VOD on April the 24th, if I'm correct.
That's correct, and it's on many, many different platforms, Amazon, Hulu. There's a lot of platforms. It's going to be on, I think, Stars. It's got a whole bunch of different platforms, yeah.
It's a great satire of rom-com and of so many different things. Bill Sorvino, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thank you so much. I had a great time.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That was my conversation with Bill Sorvino. His film, Who's Jenna, will be released on VOD on April the 24th. That does it for the show today. Be sure to follow me on Facebook at Endeavors Radio, as well on Twitter and Instagram at Endeavors Radio. And if you like what you hear, please make your way to the Patreon page and consider making a small donation. It would really help us improve and move things along. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week. Bye for now.